So, my name is Johanna Draper Carlson. I run comicsworthreading.com, and I really appreciate so many of you coming to the last panel of the day. I think we have a really interesting topic to discuss. We'll begin, I'll ask each guest to introduce themselves and their works, beginning with Andy Warner.
Hi. My name is Andy Warner. I am the author of Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, which is a collection of short four-page objects. Oh, is it not on? I guess.
I can hear you.
Everybody in the front. Short four-page comic histories retold in a sort of humorous way, very influenced by Larry Gonick. This is my new book with Sophie Dam, who's actually here in the back, a fantastic artist. So that first book I wrote and drew, and this book I wrote and Sophie drew, and it's very beautiful. She did an amazing job. And it's a collection of histories of utopian Caribbean movements, most of which ended terribly, some of which survived. Those are the ones you take hope in. And I'm also a contributing editor at The Nib, which is a publisher of nonfiction comics and comics journalism, mostly online, but last year we started to print quarterly, and we're on our third issue now, and this is the cover of our third issue, which is themed around empire. And so each of our different issues, we have a theme. The first one was death, because the death of print was our first print issue. And then we did family, and then the newest issue is themed empire. So that's me.
Is the transition slide.
Yeah, this is a good transition slide because I illustrated this. I'm an illustrator and cartoonist. My name is Ellen T. Crenshaw. I should have started with that. I do freelance illustration and children's media and history comics, which I kind of fell into by accident. This is from Colonial Comics, the first issue. There were three volumes of Colonial Comics. This was written by my husband, and it was Matt Bain. And it's about Roger Williams establishing the colony of Rhode Island. I've also done work for The Nib. There you go. Various things for The Nib. My latest work for The Nib was a piece about women's suffrage and the very messy road and how it's not perfect.
Hi, my name is James Davidge. I'm a writer from Alberta, and I've had a number of prose novels and graphic novels made, and this is my third graphic novel about Canadian history. It's called The First Nation of Utopia. It's about the founding meeting of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, who became known as the CCF. They had their first meeting in 1932. They're considered Canada's first socialist party. And we thought it was very, my publisher and I both thought it was very interesting that that occurred in Calgary, Alberta, not really known for its socialist viewpoints. But we took advantage of the energy around our recent NDP government to get this project made. And the story incorporates the history of the CCF, but we also explored a lot of different aspects of, I guess, Depression-era Canada, including just the civil unrest and the riots that were occurring. As well as we focus a lot on the Stoney Nakoda, who are First Nations just outside of Calgary towards Banff. And there you go.
So, when it comes to historical comics, how do you decide which stories to tell and how to tell them?
For me, it's I love exploring history, but I think what's important when I get a light bulb about it, it's when I feel like I can connect that history to what's going on now. I think that's, for me, what often drives how I end up mapping out the story. I want the themes to connect to what's going on in the world now. So that's definitely one motivator for me.
For me, it's partly being able to team up with a rad writer. But at the same time, I really enjoy stories from history that show the humanity, because I feel like that, you know, we can be somewhat separated from our history, and being able to see these people as human beings and having the same types of struggles that we do today helps us connect to it and remember it.
I think for me, I have a really scattered body of work. I do political stuff, I do historical stuff, I do sort of Rich Tribune. I think the thread that ties it all together is it's all nonfiction, and if it's a story that really kind of fascinates me, if I find it interesting, then I can figure out why it's interesting to me and tell it in a way that a reader would be interested in it. So the actual subject matter obviously matters a lot, but the grabbiness of the story, how like compelling I think I could make it, either writing or drawing it, is really what's important to me.
That's a great word. How do you balance truth and storytelling or entertainment?
Well, I do a lot of comics journalism work, too. So truth is very important to me, and I also recognize that it is inherently subjective as well. I mean, even when you're trying to be the best journalist on Earth, you're working with a subjective medium. And that's not just comics, of course. With comics, you're actually redrawing stuff, and so there's a certain subjectivity that's introduced in that moment. But if we're going to be honest, if you're a photographer, you're choosing the crop of your photo. If you're a documentary filmmaker, you're choosing what to leave on the cutting room floor. So I think the key is to always try to be, make it what you try to achieve that truth, knowing that at the end of the day, you're a human telling a story, and you're probably going to mess it up a little. And if you mess it up and somebody calls you out on it, you have to own it. And that's really important.
Lots and lots of research.
Yeah.
visual research, like crazy, is how I find the truth in my part in the storytelling. Because usually the script has already been written. But for me, I mean, even delving into some of the visual research, you end up finding extra little nugs of information, and being able to infuse that into the art is really exciting. And as far as the storytelling is concerned, like I said about, you know, drawing humanity and emotion into history, I just try to make, like, really fun gestures, make it look very animated and hopefully visually interesting for someone to look at the page.
Yeah, research is definitely important. For me, how I balance the storytelling part is with my last two graphic novels about Canadian history, I've created some fictional characters to sort of exist in that history, and I find that allows me to develop my fiction character development, having emotional through lines through these fictional characters, and in many ways, those characters are experiencing this history the way I am, which is being sort of just near it, but not being the main historical characters. So in my most recent book, there's around 8 real historical people, but they're more the supporting characters, and then I have these fictional characters, once again, that I can just play with a little more and not be as worried about the details. But it can be, I guess, stressful or whatever when you are working on a project, and you can be very deep into it, and suddenly something will show up to contradict what you've done, and you got to do some. But I try to. I really do strive to maintain what would be considered, I guess, historical truth.
I mean, definitely, like you said, history is so subjective. I think that's really interesting that you tell history through fictional characters. And gosh, what a great way to connect human beings today with the stories that are being told at the time.
Well, and thank you. It's a lot of fun for me. One of the characters is this. He's Nicky Burnside, and he's a performance artist. Who could possibly, his level of performance art probably didn't exist in the 30s, but I've done 2 graphic novels in the 30s, and I have a lot of fun with him, but he does bring in a lot of artistic ideas into the history, which is, you know, he's bringing in dataism into Canadian history, which is fun to do.
I think it's also really important to always remember that when you're writing historical stuff, you do sort of owe the people whose history it is your best effort. You know, mm-hmm. There is a, I don't know, like, the weight is the wrong word, but when you're telling real people's stories, you owe them something. And so that definitely weighs on you, and it keeps you on the straight and narrow a little bit.
Yeah, I remember my first graphic novel had no fictional characters, and that was a biography about about John Ware, who was a famous African-American cowboy who really got established in Calgary. And I remember when I got started researching it, I found out that his grave was a kilometer away from my house. And that was very daunting. As you say, you suddenly realize this is real. Mm-hmm. And I got butterflies more than once as I mapped out what story I would tell of his.
Why did you start doing historical comics? What led you to try that genre?
I had an opportunity to be published for the first time in, it was called Boston History Comics, a Comic History of Boston. Said, I believe it did say comic twice in the title.
For the kids, exhibition.
Right. And the only prompt was to tell a history story that took place in Boston. And this was the first story that I did with my husband, Matt Bain. And he loves Mark Twain. Mark Twain's not from Boston. However, he did give a very embarrassing speech at the Hotel Brunswick, which no longer exists in Boston, where basically he told a speech. It was supposed to be funny, as Mark Twain is, and it completely bombed. Nobody thought it was funny. He thought that he would be completely ruined forever. And that was so fun, telling this basically like Mark Twain's worst moment. That, I don't know, I just really got a flair for it. I really enjoyed the research that went into it. I got to, I got to go to the Boston Public Library and go into their, like, secret rare books room, and where you have to, like, you have to leave all of your stuff outside the door, and you can only bring no writing implements. You can only bring, like, your phone or a laptop or something in there. And they didn't make you wear gloves, but it was basically everything up until that point. And it was a labyrinth to get to this place at all. Had to ask like 15 different people how to get there. And it was so cool to be able to see literal floor plans of this hotel that no longer stood. Because my problem was, how do I draw this hotel that's not there anymore and doesn't have a lot of visual reference for me? But I did find written accounts of the hotel and what it looked like, and the floor plans, and a few postcards that just showed the outside. It was just such a fun, it was like being a detective, that I just wanted to keep doing them. It was so exciting.
My first graphic novel series is called Math and Magic, and it's about seven mathematicians from various eras in history who are mysteriously banded together to magically take on problems of a grand metaphysical nature. So it was. So that got me researching, and I'm a math teacher by trade, and I got excited by the idea of sharing, I guess, stories about mathematicians. But I wanted to make it interesting. I wanted to make it playful. So it became a work of fantasy. But that was my original goal. And then I tapped into Canadian history. My mom is really into Canadian history, so I came by that honestly, I guess, there. But anytime, whenever my three graphic novels, one is about John Ware, this famous cowboy. The next one's about the Alberta Eugenics Board. And I'm still not sure exactly why I thought that had to be a graphic novel. But it's, for me, whenever I feel like the world doesn't know too much about a particular thing, I feel inspired to create something there. And I feel it's important. So just a little moment. I don't know. It could be just with John Ware. I taught at the school and I saw a picture of him. And I went, I want to tell that story.
I found this mini comic that I did in like 2006 that was actually, it was one of the first that I'd ever done. And I had thought that I'd come to nonfiction way later than that, but it was this nonfiction story about, it was like this history story about this character, Springheel Jack, who was this character in like Penny Dreadful novels that then later went on to influence superhero mythology and all this stuff. So it started way earlier than I even expected. But after that, I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do horror fiction. I'm going to be really good at it. I was terrible at it. and I kept making these stories, and like nobody wanted to read them. And then I did this one story that was a sort of half-memoir, half-political history of when I lived in Beirut in 2005, and the government fell while I was there. And I partially told the story of Lebanese politics at the time, and Lebanese politics are like very complicated, notoriously so. And everybody really liked it, and I got such positive feedback from it that it made me really curious about this form. And so I started doing nonfiction more and more, and then it was sort of off to the races. I think I had this moment where, when I graduated from college, I almost went into academia, and I didn't. I became a cartoonist text instead. And I think it really helps me scratch that itch, you know, the ability to research, to take this whole, like, real world and find these very specialized pieces of it and then just fall into them, and then the hole that you're falling into turns out to be endless, and you have to figure out, you know, what part of this vast real story you're going to cut down to size. I found that really exhilarating, it was just way more rewarding than anything that I was doing writing fiction, which I always found was sort of this thing that I was dragging out of myself. And that was that. I really haven't looked back all that much.
What are some of the most memorable reactions from any readers of your comics?
Well, my first book, Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, I wrote for a general audience, just because that was the sort of thing that I was doing. I was writing all sorts of things. And it has, like, implied cursing in it. There's, like, an incident of castration at one point, because it was, like, a real historical event. And despite that, it, like, caught on with the middle school crowd. It, like, became really popular in middle school libraries, and which was awesome, because anytime librarians like your stuff, it, like, makes whatever you're doing a success. And one day, I got this big package in the mail, and I opened it up, and it was all these letters from this middle school class that had read it together, and then they had all done their own object histories of, like, things that they were curious about. So it was all these four-page comics from about, like, 15 different kids. Like, the originals, like, pencil, you know, drawings. It was amazing. It was, like, I cried, obviously. So probably that, yeah. It was really cool, yeah.
All right. I'm going to do, it's going to be my Mother's Day story. Because, I've shared this story quite a bit before. When I got married 10 years ago, Math and Magic was one of my few pieces of work out, and it was about these time-traveling mathematicians, and certainly, you know, a lot of fun, and quite a few people like it. But I still remember on my wedding day, my mom saying she didn't understand my work, and so that's something you remember when she said that in her speech. But recently, I'm pretty excited with First Age in Utopia. My mom's an old...
Stacks retrieval will be closed in 10 minutes. You have library material to check out.
I'm a teacher. I'm used to this. she recently got to see a copy of First Legion of Utopia, and she's an old Saskatchewan woman, and she got pretty excited when she saw Tommy Douglas in it. And so she's getting my work a bit better now. Happy Mother's Day.
This is a hard question. Some of the historical work that I do is I've done portraiture for the NIB, and one series, and you never know what's going to catch on and what's not. And one series that I did was portraits of the historical and current feminist icons, and that kind of blew up a little bit and was on BuzzFeed and stuff, and that was pretty cool. Like, I'm still nobody, but that was still exciting. But probably the, not funniest, but something that I remember, a reaction to that first Mark Twain comic, is in the original speech, Mark Twain says, "Dad fetch the lot," which at the time was a curse. And the audience is like, "Oh my gosh, my stars, my garters." And I ended up getting in an argument with the people who were going to publish the work, because nobody would know what that meant, and that was in fact a curse, and it wasn't clear. And they were right. Nobody knows what the heck that means. I think that we changed it to, like, "Dad, go it," or something like that.
Who are your artistic influences?
Well, I grew up reading so much Larry Gonick. It's funny, like, in retrospect, you could just obviously trace my career to that. But, Larry Gonick, so the cartoonist of the universe. My parents, my dad's a scientist, my mom's a teacher, so they were really into them because they were, like, teaching me stuff as I read comics. So we just had any Larry Gonick book that was available, like The Cartoonist 3 to Statistics, The Cartoon Guide to Genetics. Like, he was sort of the Isaac Asimov of that era. Like, he wrote so many books. I got to meet him, actually, when Brief Histories came out. I invited him to the launch party. I didn't think he would come, and he came. And he was this, like, huge dude looming in the corner, and I like eventually went up and said, introduced myself and realized that it was him, and like it was amazing. So probably him. Yeah.
Kate Beaton is an incredible historical cartoonist, and I just the talk about infusing humanity and humor and relatability into history. It's incredible.
A very influential series at the time, because it was a series before it was a book, is Chester Brown's Louis Riel. Mm-hmm. And I still remember finding like the floppies at a comic book store in Calgary and probably finding maybe just issue 4. And then this was back before online ordering, so just emailing Drawing Quarterly directly and and trying to figure out how I could buy copies from them before they had an online ordering system. That series was very exciting to me, and I think groundbreaking, and it definitely influenced my work.
Yeah, I remember running into the floppies of those in high school in a comic shop in like Southern California where I'm from.
Oh, wow.
And it was like such an audacious project. I was just like so taken with that. It was so cool.
Yeah, I'd be very interested to know how a Canadian would be excited by that work. It's such an interesting story.
The pacing also of that. I mean, I have it in graphic novels.
Yeah, I do too now.
Okay,
yeah.
I've never seen it in floppies. I didn't know that's how it was originally produced.
Yeah.
But it's very emotional and very quiet and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember with that having to communicate with whoever I was ordering from at Drawing Quarterly, and I think it was a pretty small office back then, and we... I was sharing my credit card on an email, and I felt very nervous about it. So I said, okay, are you Drawing Quarterly? If so, and I still remember, who is it that so-and-so did? Because there's an emotional axe murder moment there. I forget the names of the characters now, but I asked if they could identify the characters so that I could trust that it was Drawing Quarterly. Because like you see, that was an emotional scene at the start with that murder.
What advice do you have for someone who wants to make a nonfiction comic?
Go in person if you can. If you're able to get any kind of tactile, like you can start online, obviously. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But like, don't stop at Wikipedia. If you can find as much like in-person tactile at libraries, at, you know, if you go to the place where something happened. I mean, for the Roger Williams comic, we discovered that he was tried in Massachusetts for heresy right next to where I used to work. And it's not only moving and inspiring to do that, but you also are able to get a certain context, and that can really help inform the work.
Two things. First, pitch the nib. Seriously though, we publish a ton of comics. Like, we publish, I think, at least 3 comics a day. We publish 3 long form comics a week. An enormous amount of them are nonfiction. A lot of them are historical. There are places that get paid to do this sort of thing, and we publish new cartoonists. You just need to have like a website that we can look at. So put up a website before doing that. But also, just from like the actual craft perspective of it, the narrative is so huge and important. The real world is this like vast, enormous, beautiful thing, and it's like really intoxicating. There's like so many stories, and nonfiction. I say this all the time, but like nonfiction is really like reductive sculpture, and fiction is additive sculpture. And with nonfiction, you're kind of figuring out what to cut out, and it's really hard. You end up cutting these like amazing details and these side plots that like you fell in love with and spent like a day researching. But the piece is better without it. And so, like, figuring out that, like, yes, it's exciting, yes, there's so many things to talk about, but, like, what is the actual through line with the narrative, with the story of it, is really key. Because, like, history is still stories, right? It's right there in the word.
Yeah, I mean, to build on what you were saying, yeah, just remember that it is a story, even if it's nonfiction, and to craft as such, have your, you know, your story beats. Get humor in there whenever you can. And, another influence for me, my most nonfiction work would be the biography I did about John Ware, and the huge influence for me was 32 short films about Glenn Gould, which is a film that would be considered, I don't know whether you'd call it a documentary, but it's not, and it challenges what narrative structure is. It's basically telling the story of Glenn Gould through just very different types of vignettes about his life in a non-linear way. And that was very influential and for me because it forced every scene to have a certain amount of emotional weight and really think about that. And I guess find the emotion in it, in the story, whether that's humor or irony or tragedy or all of them, that's probably when you're going to hit the big one. There's some thoughts.
What's your next project? You tell me, Andy.
Okay. Well, I just had this book come out this week with Sophie, so that's like the very bleeding edge of the project that just happened. That one's cool. You should check it out. And then next year, I actually took that idea that got me into nonfiction in the first place, that memoir about living through that governmental collapse, and expanded it into a book. And St. Martin's Press is putting it out in March of 2020. So it's going to be like part political history, part memoir, sort of tracking the rise and fall of the Arab Spring from 2005 to now, especially concentrating on Lebanon and Syria. And
that mini comic was great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And then, something. Oh, and then I'm also going to go live on a volcano for a month next month and draw comics from all volcanoes. No, it's super cool. I got this, residency in the national park in Hawaii and this house, and the only stipulation is that I have to draw comics about volcanoes, not fiction comics. So keep an eye out on the net. I'm going to be doing some volcano comics.
Cool. Yeah. I'm in the middle of doing, random illustration freelance. I'm celebrating my first graphic novel with the author Colleen A.F. Venable, who's in the audience right now. And it turns out that it's kind of a history comic because it takes place in 2004, which was a very different time and so required a certain amount of historical research, like people have flip phones.
You might should say the title.
Oh, yes, Kiss Number 8. Yeah.
Which is also super good. Y'all really need to check that out.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm just getting started on a project, but I'm excited because I just met with a co-writer that I'm working with, Cheyenne Martin, and he lives in Toronto here, but his family's originally from northern Alberta, and he's Métis. And we're going to be telling a story. It's going to be the third part in my character, Holly Burnside's epic Albertan journey. And it's called the Blue Quill School Rebellion, and it's about it's a true story in St. Paul, Alberta, in around 71-72, as they were phasing out residential schools. Blue Quill was a residential high school, and the First Nations people there didn't want it to shut down. So what they did was they staged an occupation, and so it famously now got handed over to them. And it became the very first First Nations autonomously run school, and it's called the Blue Quill Tribal College, still running to this day. So we're just getting on the ground floor, starting to connect. I got quite excited that an old junior high friend of mine, I found out his family was part of the legal process of this happening. So he's he and his mom are into researching that part of their family. So they're gonna steer some of their research energy into helping me with this project, but we're just on the ground floor. It's just started thinking about it on Friday.
Oh, that's so exciting.
It is. Yeah.
Are there any questions from the audience? Let me bring you a mic.
Sure. Thank you. Just thinking about obviously we're talking about. Non-fiction is always a story. What do you think are the different kind of benefits, downsides, or strengths, or whatever, of kind of an essay, essay comic style approach to a historical subject versus, a traditional comic narrative that's telling a historical story? Thanks.
Well, working for the NIB, we published both. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of both. And I think they really have their place. I mean, I think that you can educate people with a historical narrative, and obviously convey an enormous amount of information. And they're definitely more engaging to read But sometimes people just want like an explainer comic because they want to know what the hell is happening in Yemen. And that has as important a place. So I think it's context. And it's also sort of what you want to do. Like, people are good at different ones. Some people are really good at explainers. Some people are really good at history. Some people are good at both. Some people are good at neither. So experiment and see what works. See what people like. I don't know.
A lot, too, has to do with how much space you have. Like, mm-hmm. if you have infinite pages to be able to tell the story that you want, I mean, this is probably biased, but I feel like, you know, more pictures rather than words. And I feel like that can often be more engaging. But like you said, I mean, the essay comics still have their place, and they can convey much more information. And if you have, say, only like 6 pages to tell a story, it can often be very wordy because you have to provide context and tell who these people are, and it can be very challenging. So it's a matter of editing as much as you can and figuring out how best to tell that story within whatever parameters you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you said, there's room for both and for all, and so I guess if you have specific goals, I think lots of organizations are finding that comics are good ways to just convey information, whether it's history or how to operate this machine or what have you. So there's that's becoming, I think, a growing method of communication. I know friends in Alberta who are getting jobs with, like, workplace hazardous material.
I've done a few comics with civic issues.
Yeah, and I'm on the political action committee of our teachers association, and we're certainly using comics. I mean, you grab lots of people, and often just with a one page thing of information that has some images. But going back to why I love just using fiction is I find the history for me just starts to come alive, and I find my goal is to create a work of literature, is to create something that the history is just a part of, and you're potentially just tapping into what it is to be human, what it is to exist, and that for me is when I get really excited that I feel like I've created something that's gone deeper than the history.
Yeah, to your point about there being so many spots for this, I totally agree. And like, context is actually a big part of that too. So there's an enormous amount of places that want explainers right now. Like, a ton of newspapers, like online newspapers, like The Guardian publishes comics journalism and explainers too, and so they're probably easy to sell, honestly, as a freelancer. But then long form to publishers would be way easier to sell, like a book with a narrative. So the context of where you're actually hoping it ends up.
Well, forgive me for jumping in, but as a critic, please make it clear why it's a comic. Mm-hmm. If I can just read the text and get the same amount of information, yeah, pictures are nice, but make sure they're contributing something to what you're doing. And in many cases, they will. You can see what people are talking about.
My question is following up on what you just said about selling. Mm-hmm. So all three of you are indicating that you're making the creative choices, except sometimes for Ellen, is following your lead. But you're indicating that the creators are making most of the content choices. Do your editors and publishers come back and say, we won't be able to sell that? Or on the other hand, do they tell you, I think we need to do something on Trudeau because we need to push some content, push some sales?
Well, so just super quick to be perfectly clear, everybody writes comics in a different way. And the way I write comics is actually very spare. Like, you've worked with my scripts. And Sophie has too. So the people who draw when I write, because I write and draw as well, I would say that the artists actually bring as much as, if not more, like time-wise, way more.
Thank you.
I know with my most recent graphic novel, it was one where I got a letter of interest from the publisher, really from the ground floor, and that helped me get the grants that I needed to hire the artist to get the work done. And so, yeah, there was very telling a story about the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, who became the NDP in 1961.
Would be a little bit more commercial and easier to sell.
It was, yeah, I mean, this was 2 years ago. We knew there'd be, in Alberta, we knew there'd be an important NDP-focused election last month. So it was all timed around that, and that definitely helped sell the product, the idea to my publisher. And, yeah, for sure. So I think, I know with publishers, they have to understand. I mean, they want to sell books, so you've got to make, you know, you've got to have a reason for it coming out, not right. just because you think that history is interesting.
Right, so my question is, do your publishers say, no, we won't be able to sell a biography about this guy, or I think I really need you to do a story on this other guy to sell some books?
I mean, a lot of that is sort of from yourself, too. Like, as a creator, you want people to read what you make. I mean, some people don't. Some people are perfectly... I know, that's like a totally valid choice. Like, I have friends that like are great cartoonists, and all they want to do is like sit alone and draw their comics, and they actually don't really care if people read them or not. And that's totally fine and cool. But what actually I find really engaging is this idea of like taking what I'm excited about and making other people excited about it. And oftentimes that's tied to like the news cycle, that's tied to what's going on politically. And so like keeping your eye on that, like sure there's pressure from publishers, but there's also pressure from myself. And it's usually some sort of synergy between the two where you're like working with them and you're like, what is going to be interesting in like a month? What's going to be interesting in 2 years? Mm-hmm. Depends on where you're publishing. Because if it's online, then like something could come out next year. If it's like a book, then it's like 2 years from now. So
often the publisher will concern themselves more with when it's going to come out. Yeah. Because if it's content that's good, that people will be interested in, it will be published. It's just a matter of when's the best time for it to drop. In the mm-hmm. case of the NIB, you know, you do something about women's suffrage. Well, let's do it during Women's History Month first.
Yeah. I think that goes back to, I think when you're exploring history, you, for me personally, I have to have a sense of why it, how it connects to now, and I think because of that, one thing, publishers will want to have a sense of that, you know, usually, often.
And also having been on the other end of that, an editor, at the NIB, we have these meetings where we're like, these are the stories we want to do, who are the people who would be good at these stories, and we do reach out to people and ask people to do stories that they haven't pitched to us, if we think that a story needs to be told right now, next month, whatever.
Any other questions?
How do you know when you've done enough research?
when it's time to get it drawn.
Yeah, you've never done enough research.
That's way too true.
Good evening, everyone. Just letting you know that TCAF closes in 20 minutes. TCAF closes in 20 minutes. Please make your final purchases and head towards the exit. Thank you.
Thanks, God.
Deadlines are super helpful in letting you know when it's time to stop researching. If you've got the deadline coming up, it's like, well, it's good enough.
No, that's totally true.
It's so easy to go down a rabbit hole of research, too, once you've gotten into detective mode and you're just interested in what's happening. It's a snowball effect. But at the end of the day, you got to get it done. So.
Yeah, I think it would never stop. And I think what happens for me, once I start getting the script going, the research doesn't stop till the last page is done. It has to stop for me once I hand it over to the artist. And that can be, you know, stressful or whatever. But especially when you meet someone that knows more about your topic than you do, which happens all the time for me, and then suddenly you realize that, oh, there was maybe that little glitch or that little contradiction, and you wonder how you're going to take it on when it's already been drawn as a three-page scene or whatever. You know, you hope just changing one word one will fix it.
That's a good point, actually. It's always important to have humility in this, because somebody will always know more than you. And they'll come up to your table at a convention. Yeah. Like,
which is why I think we all make sure we do as much research as we can so that doesn't happen. It will happen.
So if you were asked to host an episode of Drunk History, or if you don't drink, it'd be Seltzer History, what would be the story you would tell? So what is your favorite story in history?
Oh,
that's
my goodness.
That's a hard one.
Well, I literally just spent 20 minutes last night drunkenly telling the story of the Cathar Crusade in France, so that one's fresh in my mind, but I don't know, there's a bunch.
That is a mean and hard question, Colleen. How dare you? Basically, my mind is going blank at this time, and all I can think of is, like, Mark Twain doing anything, because he's so weird.
Last night when I wouldn't say I was drunk, but I was socializing, and, for me, you can get me started on a weird mathematician history, and my favorite ones are mathematicians. When I researched Mathemagic, my goal there was to either get mathematicians who had made, you know, significant contributions to thought or had very interesting deaths. And so, yeah, I could do a whole lot. Maybe the few people who could do mathematician death drug history. Anyway, yeah, I'm available.
This is probably a bad drunk history, but I think it's really interesting that I learned this from an anthropologist, that the Boston accent is the closest in North America to the original English accent from when settlers came over to Boston. So today's English accent is not what it was, language changes. And this crazy, raw Boston accent is what it was somehow. It's the closest thing. It's very strange. So think of that when you see, like, the town or something.
They already did my favorite episode, which is Agatha Christie's disappearance.
Sacred murder.
Anyway, I think we will wrap up early so people have a last chance to get back on the floor and start exiting the show, as they have warned us. So thank you very much to our panelists.
Thank you.